The church's music from the 20th century. The 17th century. The 11th century. The 8th century. The 4th century. The best of the church's music from the past 2,000 years. LutheranPublicRadio.org.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. I thought that this was the Babylon Bee, but no, it was Union Seminary. A tweet: today in chapel we confessed to plants. Together we held our grief, joy, regret, hope, guilt, and sorrow in prayer, offering to them, to the beings who sustain us, but whose gift we too often fail to honor. What do you confess to plants in your life? It's not satire. It's what happens at Union Seminary. And then there's a story from Duke. Duke, which is a Protestant, or at least Protestant origin university, beautiful, huge chapel on that campus there, has decided that they will deny official status to a group called Young Life because of their views on homosexuality. Their views, although Duke says it's their policies. We'll see whether that makes any difference. Joining us for media coverage of mainline Protestant education, Terry Mattingly, Senior Fellow for Media and Religion at the King's College in New York City, author of the weekly On Religion column for the Universal Syndicate and the book Pop Goes Religion, and founder and editor of Get Religion. Terry, welcome back.
Glad to be here.
Let's start with Duke and Young Life. What's the important news in that story?
Well, it's the latest of many, many conflicts over this issue that have been going back for decades. And you might be interested in knowing that long ago, when I covered a similar story in the Ivy League, that was the first time I ever met a young Harvard lawyer by the name of David French, was defending InterVarsity at that time. And the important thing for journalists to realize when covering the Duke story is that private colleges and universities have a right to determine the creeds, so to speak, or the doctrines that will govern life on their campus. But what's interesting is to read coverage of the Duke story, which is based on the ability of a liberal arts private college and university to determine what doctrines are good and what doctrines are bad, especially when they're lived out on their campus, and contrast those stories with the coverage of the exact same issue when it arises in a conservative religious college, where all of a sudden you have a doctrinal covenant that says students and teachers should be striving to live a certain way and defend a certain set of doctrines. It's the same thing. Private schools have a right to define the creeds and covenants that govern their campus. Yet at Duke, we get coverage that doesn't seem to have any awareness at all that this is the same essential issue within private education as we see in conservative schools. At Duke, the college is completely right. The students are completely wrong. And that's that. When you see most mainstream coverage of the same issue when it occurs on a conservative campus, the protesting students are completely right and the school is totally wrong, even though in both cases, the schools are acting within their rights. The issue is whether the school is being very honest about what they're doing and whether they're applying these doctrines equally to different groups on their own campus. Let me give you an example in a conservative setting. At a lot of conservative Christian schools, the policy is that sex outside of marriage is sin. Now, does the college seem to work as hard in terms of public pronouncements, chapel services, disciplinary actions, etc.? Does the conservative college seem to apply that law as consistently to heterosexual students as to homosexual students? I've taught on Christian college campuses, and I've seen students doing everything just short of conceiving children on couches in the lobby of dormitories in terms of sexual activity of the petting variety. And nobody says a word, yet, you know, if two gay students touched hands or looked at each other strange, it probably would be reported. Do you see the point I'm trying to make? Same policy, are you applying it equally? Well, at Duke, Duke seems to think that evangelical Protestants are the only campus religious groups who believe that sex outside of marriage is sin. Doesn't that strike you somewhat strange? 5 years ago, in a similar dispute at another previously Methodist school, Vanderbilt, when they suddenly realized that other groups were affected, they ended up pushing 14, this is at the time, it may be more since then, 14 different groups were pushed off campus. And that affected between 1 and 2,000 Roman Catholic, Evangelical, and Latter-day Saint students got pushed off campus because, lo and behold, Catholics, Mormons, and other people also believe that sex outside of marriage is sin. You'd have trouble convincing me that there are student groups of a religious nature at Duke for Muslims that do not have some sort of policy that the leaders of the organization should be practicing Muslims who believe the tenets of their faith. I would find it very, very difficult to believe that isn't the case. So did I explain that? I was able to make that clear?
Yes, and I want to stay with Duke for just a minute here before going on to Union Seminary. You noticed something in the Religion News Service story, the term their policy. He says, you say it rings like a bell through the entire thing. What do you detect there in that term policy?
Well, once again, they're trying to use secular or even political differences. They're not saying, in effect, that this is a clash between two different moral theologies. If you cover this story as Duke has a theology that it believes is right, a moral theology that it believes is right, and Young Life, Catholics, Orthodox, Orthodox Jews, Mormons, etc., these other people have a moral theology that they believe is right, doesn't that make the whole thing sound more like religion instead of like a secular legal discrimination case in some way? I think to some degree people are uncomfortable with the religious element of this. 5 years ago, when I wrote that story about Vanderbilt, one of the evangelical leaders on the campus made a really interesting observation. She said that it was fascinating that Vanderbilt had been Methodist way in the past, but had gradually and proudly moved away to a non-sectarian stance. And she said what Vanderbilt couldn't admit and state publicly was that Vanderbilt had become a religious school again. Vanderbilt was saying that there are correct doctrines on marriage and sexuality, and we will enforce them, and we will push off campus the groups that have the incorrect doctrines about marriage and sexuality. It's kind of interesting to stop and think about Duke, which is a very similar school. in many ways. There's no question about the United Methodist heritage of Duke, and there are still some ties that sort of bind or don't bind at the level of trustees, etc. But, you know, I suggested that reporters might try to find out if on the Duke campus, is there a United Methodist ministry on the campus? And if so, is the United Methodist ministry going to be pushed off campus? Because, I mean, famously, I mean, we've all been covering stories for decades right now. The discipline of the United Methodist Church teaches that the practice of, I'm quoting now, the practice of homosexuality is incompatible with Christian teaching. Therefore, self-avowed practicing homosexuals are not allowed to be candidates ordained as ministers or appointed to serve in the United Methodist Church. In other words, to be a leader in the in a United Methodist Church ministry, you should believe the teachings of the United Methodist Church. Young Life is saying that to be a leader in Young Life, you should believe the teachings of Young Life. And they're not going to ban anybody who wants to attend meetings or wants to come forward and wants to ask questions and wants to challenge the group or whatever. Any, you know, bring them on. Everybody can come to the meetings. Everybody can take part. But to be a teaching leader of the organization, they're saying that you should believe the doctrines of that organization. I'll give you one more parallel. I bet you that there are environmental groups on the Duke campus. And I bet that those environmental groups advocate certain positions on doctrinal issues related to climate change, etc. I wonder if it would be possible to become a leader of a major environmental group on the Duke campus if the person was very openly stating they did not believe anything the group stood for, and in fact, they denied the reality of climate change. Do you think that would be very likely to happen? So the use of the word policies is fascinating because that makes the whole thing sound just like legalisms. If you make the word what it actually should be in these disputes, which is doctrines, that changes the whole picture, or it at least makes you look at it through a different lens.
Terry Mattingly is our guest. We're talking about media coverage of mainline Protestant education. On the other side of the break, Union Seminary sent out a tweet about a special ritual during their chapel service, confessing to plants. What's the news in this story? We'll find out next. If you appreciate Issues Etc., Talk Radio for the Thinking Christian, and Lutheran Public Radio, Sacred Music for the World, please include a bequest in your will or trust for these worldwide media resources. Bequests aren't subject to federal tax or capital gains taxes. Ensure your children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren the opportunity to listen by including a bequest in your will or trust for Issues Etc. and Lutheran Public Radio.
Looking for a foreign language program that will revolutionize your students' vocabulary knowledge and their understanding of grammar? How about a program that teaches critical thinking skills, too? Look no further than Memoria Press's Latin curriculum. Students of all ages can use these Latin study programs. Give your students the gift of Latin today. To order, visit memoriapress.com and save $5 on your next order by using the coupon code LPR9. Memoria Press, saving Western civilization one student at a time.
Smartest listeners in radio. You're listening to Issues Etc.
What is the Lutheran Witness? Simple. It's a monthly magazine on faith and life, theology and culture that helps readers interpret the contemporary world from a Lutheran Christian perspective. Filled with expert insights, good writing, and inspiring stories, it also provides essential church information for LCMS members. What is the Lutheran Witness? Simple. It's the flagship periodical of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, and it has been for more than a century. Visit cph.org/witness to subscribe today.
Hey, Todd, what have our listeners noticed first when visiting the LPR studios?
Definitely the small size and the dirt.
Well, not anymore, thanks to our friends at the Cleaning Authority. They've turned this man cave into a space that meets even our wives' approval.
Whether it's our office or your home, the Cleaning Authority is your cleaning service provider in the St. Louis area.
To schedule a free estimate or to find out more, visit thecleaningauthority.com. Thecleaningauthority.com.
Welcome back. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc. We're talking with Terry Mattingly about media coverage of mainline Protestant education. He's Senior Fellow for Media and Religion at the King's College in New York City, author of the weekly On Religion column for the Universal Syndicate and the book Pop Goes Religion. He's founder and editor of Get Religion. Terry, turning to this fascinating kind of you-can't-look-away-from-it tweet from Union Seminary, today in chapel, we confessed to plants. What's the news story here?
Well, to me, what's really interesting about this one is there's probably nothing about this story that's all that unusual at Union Theological Seminary. When you actually look at the nature of that seminary and you look at the community of people who send students there, the community of churches and other groups that send students there for education, you look at the fact that this is now a very influential but very small seminary, currently with about 220 students on campus. The mathematics of that is really kind of interesting because they have 25 full-time faculty with 220 students. It's kind of interesting, and they're not exactly in an inexpensive place to do business, sitting in the same neighborhood as Columbia University. But I would argue that there are a lot of very interesting news stories linked to Union Theological Seminary and to this one. But the fact that they're praying to plants or involving in a liturgy that involves confessing humanity's sins to the creation or to representatives of the creation, that may not be very big news at all. I wrote an essay way back in the early 90s called Liturgical Dances with Wolves about a service at the Episcopal Cathedral not far from there that, I mean, you know, they had a humpback whale singing the Sanctus. The preacher was the late Carl Sagan. They prayed to African river gods. This was way beyond what was described at this Union service. So, is the prayer service the news story here, or was this a chance to do actual coverage about several topics, one of which I suggested was worship trends on what everyone's considering the revived religious left? In other words, everybody seems to want to talk about the religious left as if it was a political lobby. These people actually do have theological beliefs. And in this case, you have another story here, and that this was a chance to write a story about the implications of decades worth of environmental theology. What some people have called Gaia liturgy, this kind of neo-pantheistic thing that it works really great on Oprah, but it's not having a lot of success with people in the pews. Another story linked to Union right now is, how are they keeping the doors open? What's the financial realities of the school? I mean, and what religious groups will actually help fund future clergy going there for education? On their website right now, let me read you a list of religious traditions they say are currently represented in their student body. Baptist, Pagan, AME Zion, Buddhist, Hindu, Episcopal, Catholic, Lutheran, Jewish, Muslim, Church of Christ, Friends, Quaker, Mennonite, Unitarian Universalist, Orthodox, Reformed Church in America, and Seventh-day Adventist. And I immediately wondered, okay, where are the United Methodists? Because I've seen other people arguing online about the fact that this is a school that United Methodist ministers have the option of going to and being certified. Now, the fact that a denomination will let you go to this seminary and get ordained when you graduate is not the same thing as the denomination sending its money to the seminary to help fund those studies. But that's a good question to dig into. Also, worship on this campus must be really interesting. The chapel has been reconfigured in a way that it can be used for literally anything. In its discussions of the Confessing Sins to Plants liturgy, the school put out releases on Twitter, and one of them noted that one day you may come in and find a traditional Anglican communion in the chapel. Another day you may enter into a service of Buddhist meditation or Muslim prayer. Another, you may find a Pentecostal praise service or a silent Quaker meeting. The goal, it said, is to, quote, create a home where people can worship side by side in traditions similar to and very different to their own. Through this process, we learn from our neighbors and discern our own faith more deeply. Now, that's all pretty normal, liberal mainline Protestant stuff right now, and it's been that way for quite some time. At the same time, it's kind of hard to picture it, isn't it? I'm having trouble picturing traditional members of some of those faiths, traditional Baptist with traditional Muslims, with traditional Unitarians, with traditional pagans, sitting next to a Missouri Synod Lutheran in chapel there, and finding a whole lot in common that can be expressed in terms of worship and liturgy, which gets us to the final thing that I wish the coverage of the story, and most of the coverage, as you would imagine, is conservative publications. I simply wanted to know, in fact, my plan is to call the seminary up and see if I can get an answer to this question. I'm wondering what the liturgies actually said. I would like to read the liturgies. It'd be interesting to know if the prayers were said to the plants, or were the prayers confessions of sin to God, confessing sins against God's creation, meaning the plants and other things. You catch the theological distinction right there, obviously, correct?
Yes, because one would be, while maybe silly, the other would be rank paganism. I don't know what else to call it.
Well, it certainly is pantheism. Now, I caught that, and I was interested in it because of a book I read years ago called Orthodox Alaska, which was about the work of Eastern Orthodox missionaries when they moved into the Aleut and Eskimo cultures of Alaska. And it mentioned in particular that there was a ritual that the Native American believers were doing where they did a liturgical procession to the river, and they prayed to the salmon, thanking the salmon for their sacrifice on behalf of the feeding the community, et cetera, et cetera. When Orthodox missionaries came there, they saw this ritual, and they tried to figure out, well, what are we going to do with this? This is a really big thing to the Aleut and the Eskimo people. This is a crucial part of their beliefs. And what the Orthodox did was create a liturgy where they marched to the river with Christian symbolism, crosses, incense, the whole bit. And standing on the banks of the river, they prayed liturgies to God, thanking God for the salmon and thanking God for the other gifts of his creation, which allowed them to live their lives day after day after day. There's a huge theological difference between those two liturgical processions, and it's in the words. So I guess part of what I would say is I am interested in knowing if it's possible to cover this story in a way in which we find out what they actually said. Isn't that actually kind of a interesting factual question to ask about the service?
Finally, on that one, Terry, why do you think, while it made a big flap on Twitter, and it was shared by virtually everyone who is interested in theology, even in a peripheral way, why was it largely ignored in the media?
Frankly, I don't know. Like I said, we've read lots of stories recently about an emerging or re-emerging religious left, and I've read oodles of stories about the importance of environmental theology. So I think this is one of those cases that once the right had kind of defined this as a joke, that made publications in the mainstream, which culturally and theologically would tend to represent the left, made them kind of back away. And then, like you said, there was also, to some degree, this really did seem like a Babylon Bee story. And sure enough, the Babylon Bee has a story up now, which seemed inspired by some of the Twitter themes comparing this story obliquely to Little Shop of Horrors, kind of Little Seminary of Horrors. And the headline at the Babylon Bee is "Disaster at Union Seminary as Giant Angry Carnivorous Plant Does Not Accept Students' Apologies." I can take that one or leave it. Until we find out what these people said, I really don't think we know what this story was all about.
Terry Mattingly is Senior Fellow for Media and Religion at the King's College in New York City. He is author of the weekly On Religion column for the Universal Syndicate and the book Pop Goes Religion. He's founder and editor of Get Religion. Terry, thank you very much for your time.
Glad to be here.
Tomorrow on Issues Etc., we'll talk with Dr. Larry Rast about a statement presented by Lutheran leaders on September 20th, 1945, called the Statement of the 44 and why it's important. We'll also discuss God, original sin, the Son of God, and justification from the Augsburg Confession with Pastor Paul McCain. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Issues Etc., P.O. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.
College Preparation Station is proud to announce the opening of its first Missouri location, Creve Coeur. College Preparation Station provides ACT, SAT, PSAT instruction, and college scholarship guidance. Their new Creve Coeur branch is located at 11,500 Olive Boulevard. Learn more at cpsprep.com or call 314-750-5967. College Preparation Station in Creve Coeur, Missouri, and Maryville, Illinois, cpsprep.com.
In a world awash with all sorts of information, opinions, and ideas, there is still a place where God's Word is the central and only focus. Messiah Lutheran Church, 801 North Madison, Lebanon, Illinois. At 9 o'clock on Sunday mornings, God's people gather there to listen to Him. There you will find His words of law and gospel, and of course, our Lord's Holy Supper. Bible classes focus on the Bible and the Lutheran confessions. Come, listen, believe, and live, and check out our website at messiahlebanon.org.